Welcome to Unspoken. This week, I am joined by Grace McDonald, who is the mum of the world's first test tube boy. She paved the way for IVF treatment and gave birth to the world's second IVF baby. Grace was first told that she was infertile in 1974, but by chance, she discovered the research being conducted by Patrick Steptoe, Robert Edwards, and Jean Purdy, whose story is told in the recent Netflix release of Joy. Following the last episode with Jack Thorne and Rachel Mason talking about the creation and the greenwriting of the film Joy, Grace talks to us about her own personal experience of being part of the first IVF trials that were a success. Grace is really candid and really open and really paints the picture of what it was like back then to experience fertility treatment and also to not understand the enormity of what she was going through. So Grace has been quite open and sharing her journey and also trying to create positive change for those who are experiencing fertility treatment. Hope you enjoy this episode. So welcome to this episode of Unspoken. Today we are very lucky to be joined by Grace McDonald, who was the world's second IVF mum and gave birth to the first boy through IVF. Welcome, Grace. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Anita. Very well, thank you.
Good, good. And I know you've been awfully busy recently with everything surrounding the film Joy. I can imagine you've been kind of having lots of interviews, lots of conversations about your experience of IVF and what it was like for you back then.
Yes, it's funny, after all these years of being quiet and sort of just carrying on a very normal life, that over the last few months, it's just been, it's been a whirlwind, really. There's been so much publicity and interest in because of the film Joy. But in a way, it's been wonderful because I hope it has highlighted for other women, you know, just what we went through, but not to give up. You know, if it works for us, then hopefully it can work for many, many more women in our situation.
And I think what you just shared, yeah, it's absolutely, it's holding on to that hope. And I'm guessing back in the kind of early 1970s, just taking it back to when your own journey started, how was it for you? And tell us a little bit more about what your experience of infertility was like back then.
Well, it all kind of started about 1972 when I had actually in many ways not understood why I hadn't become pregnant. And I went to see a gynecologist in Stob Hill Hospital in Glasgow because I was living near Glasgow at the time. And I just explained to him that nothing was happening. So he decided that I should come in and have a laparoscopy. And when he did do the laparoscopy, to cut a very long story short, he discovered that my tubes were blocked and that I had a lot of ovarian cysts and adhesions. I was really in a bit of a mess. So he said, the way things are looking, you'll never be able to be a mum, which I just thought, oh no, I won't accept that. There's got to be some other way. So he actually did an operation to put in little, like, I don't know, like tiny little tubes into my fallopian tubes to see if he could open them, but it didn't work. And that was really basically, as far as he was concerned, all he could do for me. So I left, well, obviously just went back to my normal life teaching in Glasgow. And it was, funnily enough, it was about 1975. I was visiting friends who actually was a friend who was a doctor. And I happened to pick up a magazine in their house on the coffee table. And inside was an article about Patrick and Bob, telling us, and really the article was about this very new innovative way that they were developing of hopefully helping childless couples have children. So I took a note of the names. I didn't say anything. I just took a note of it. And then I went back to see David Mackay Hart, who was my specialist at, you know, the gynecologist at Stobhill. And I said to David, look, I found out about this. He didn't know about it. But I said, I'm very interested in this. Could you follow this up? And he said, I'll tell you what, we'll both follow it up. So he wrote to Patrick, and so did I. And eventually I got a letter back from Mr. Stetto asking me if I would come down to visit him to see if I would be a candidate that, you know, that he could take on to the program. So that's really how it all started.
Gosh, what a journey that you were in the right place at the right time. You happened to see this magazine article. Just going back to when you were told by your doctor, you know, you've got blocked fallopian tubes and you have ovarian cysts and you're not going to conceive. How was that for you to hear that?
Well, obviously at the time it was devastating because I just thought it was the end of all my hopes of ever having a family of my own. But deep down, I don't know, it's just something in me. I never, ever take no for an answer. And I just thought, no, I'm never giving up. I'm going to try anything I can. So I was always looking out for other, you know, any articles, anything that could, that I felt would maybe be able to help me. Although at that time, obviously, there was nothing. But when I saw that article, it jumped out at me. I just felt it was meant. It was just a fluke that was definitely, I had to follow it up because I knew that there was no other way. So that's why I was willing to, you know, to really do anything that would give me the family that I wanted.
Yeah, and I think as you were just talking, what really struck me is that you had this almost your resilience and you were determined that, this is not something I'm going to accept. I am going to try and push forward and find what is out there. And this is a time where there was no internet. So you couldn't just go and Google and search for things and, you know, find options and other things that might help you. So it very much was down to you to actually proactively go out and look for things.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Because even the medical professionals had kind of given me no hope. They had said, well, you just have to accept it. And just something in me said, no, I'll never accept it. I want to try every avenue that's available. And at that time, obviously, this was the only thing that I'd seen that I thought, well, I must become part of this. Although at the time, I knew it was still in its very embryonic stages, that there was nobody who had actually been successful by that time. But my attitude was, somebody's going to have to do it. And we're all the girls, once I met them, I realised we were all the same. We were all in the same boat. We were all determined to try our best. And if we didn't do it for us, we could do it for other people. And that in some ways gave me comfort, that I felt that, well, if it doesn't work for me, maybe what I've gone through will help someone else.
And I've heard about the Ovum Club, and obviously it's mentioned in the film, and I've read about it. So it sounds like it was a group of you women who are going through the same thing, and you are a support system for each other, especially when you're in the trials. You're in the, like you say, you're in the same boat. You had the same aspirations. What was it like to be part of that community?
No, it's from the film, it's actually misrepresented in the film. We were not, because the whole thing was very secret, we really didn't contact anybody else. I did, because one of the other girls on the program was in Glasgow, and we're still very good friends to this day. We happened to go down at the same time in 1977. But I would say that the one person who was the kind of our godmother for the group was Marlene Platt, who should have had the first baby, but it was ectopic. Now, Marlene was there in 1977 when I went into Kershaw's, which again is nothing like the film. Kershaw's was the loveliest little cottage hospital. And it was really quite sad because people in it were mainly, it was a hospice really. There were people who were elderly and dying, actually. But the girls that we were, I was only in with a small group. And I kept in touch with all of them, just really in the hope that, you know, that one of us would, you know, would be successful. We're from all different walks of life, but it wasn't really like, unfortunately, it wasn't like a club at that stage. It was the following year when I wasn't successful in 1977. So went home in the train crying my eyes out, determined I wasn't giving up. So I came back down the year after in 1978 in the May, and Marlene was there again, and I phoned my friend in Glasgow and said, get yourself down here, please come back. So she did, she came back again. But no, we didn't actually have a way of, because we weren't really supposed to know who else was on the program. It was very, you know, it was kept very kind of quiet. And again, because Patrick and Bob and Jeannie didn't want anything, you know, the press to get hold of us. That was the main thing, because they had had a horrible time and they didn't want any of us to go through that. So when I went back in 1988, in the May, I did become pregnant, and there was a group of us there. I think because it was going to be the last batch, really, before Patrick retired. One of my friends who had been in with us the year before, she was back again, and we decided we should really give Patrick a nice present from all of us. And we wrote a card, and it was my pal and I who came up with the name, the Ovum Club. So it wasn't way back. It was right towards the very end of being at Kershaw's, because that was the last, no. There was one batch after I became pregnant. I was in the hospital on my own for a couple of weeks. And then there was the last batch of 21 girls came in, as well as me, still there. And we, as I said, that was going to be the last lot before Patrick retired. And they were going to close down Kershaw's, not the hospice, but our part of it. Because the NHS in Oldham, who had been wonderful, giving, you know, supporting Patrick and Bob and Jeannie, but there were, of course, because Patrick was no longer going to be an NHS doctor, they couldn't provide the facilities any longer. So that's where it came from. In the film, it looked as if it came very much earlier on, but it didn't. It was actually in 1988.
Ah, right. Okay, so it's a lot later down the line. And it sounds like, you know, it's quite interesting that you're placed in a hospice where people are coming to the end of life and you are trying to begin life. That's such a contrast. And
that's what always hit me. In fact, there was an article in one of the Sunday papers up here, and the reporter, he quoted me in that, because I did say that. That really hit home with me, that it was the end of life, that there was these lovely old ladies, and one in particular, I became very, very close to. I used to sit and chat to her, especially when I was there for that fortnight on my own. And she was so positive. She had a tracheotomy. She couldn't talk to me properly. She used to press her neck because she didn't have a voice box anymore. But I've never come across such a positive and wonderful. She gave me such strength. But she kept saying to me, Grace, positive thinking, you know, you'll get there. This'll this is going to work for you. And we weren't allowed to talk about it, but they were well aware of what was going on. But it was so funny because at one end of the ward, it was a great big ward, one end of the ward, there were people trying to bring life into the world. And at the other end of the ward, there was these dear old ladies who were leaving, you know, and it really hit home to me that, you know, that was life, you know, the beginning and the end. And we were all in there together.
Yeah, must been quite an experience. And like you said, you were, you know, you came down from Scotland and you were there by yourself.
Yeah.
How was it during your first trial when you went there, when you first arrived? Tell me a bit about how that was.
Yeah, well, I came down on the train from Glasgow, and I had to go and sort of check in at Kershaw's. You have to go through the ritual, you know, of bloods and the hormone. At that time, we were still getting hormone treatment. So you'd go in, and, you know, the first day it was meeting Bob and Patrick and Jeannie, who were wonderful, explaining exactly what was going to happen, because I had no idea. And then they said, you'll probably for the first week, you won't be an inpatient. You'll have to stay somewhere outside. And if you can please come in every morning you know, have your injections and bloods taken. And we used to have to carry around a container so that your wee-wee went into the... you know, that was the way that they could tell if the LH surge, you know, was going to happen. I booked into a B&B in Oldham itself. But I was very, very lucky because I had been down in the December of 1976. Patrick he asked me to come down because he wanted to double check that everything was all right inside. But remember, that was from 72 when I'd had that kind of big operation done. And this was now 76. And Patrick, it was the week before Christmas, and he did a laparoscopy and he said, no, you're back in a terrible state inside. I think it was the endometriosis was also played at that time. And so that was just the week before Christmas. No, it wasn't. It was just a few days before Christmas. And on Christmas Eve, he actually had to do a major operation where he removed both my tubes, one of my ovaries.
Wow.
Cleaned up all the septic adhesions, because I was really in an awful mess. But I remember on Christmas morning, he came in with his little granddaughter, who was just lovely. I think she was called Vicky Victoria. And he said, well, I've got good news and bad news for you, Grace. And I said, all right, give me it. You know, tell me, you know, give me the bad news first. So he said, I've had to, you know, clean you all up inside. You were in an awful mess. Told me what he had taken away. And then he said, but the good news is there's nothing wrong with, you know, with what's left. So I'll accept you on the program. So that's why I was in there for 2 weeks. And then I was back down in February for my first attempt in 77. But in the meantime, I met some of the girls who had been in Kershaw's had been decanted into that ward in Oldham, in the main hospital, because I don't know whether they were closing Kershaw's for the Christmas holidays. But those, it was wonderful. I guessed, and there was one girl in particular I became very, very close. I still am. I'm still very close to her. And she kind of, she was very cagey when I said to her, are you by any chance here on a special program with Mr. Stetler? She was very wary. And I just kind of said to her, well, I'm hoping that I'm going to be accepted on it. So we became firm friends, and she was there over Christmas, and she explained quite a lot to me, which was great. So at least I had some idea of what I was facing. But then there was another amazing girl who was in the bed opposite me, and she'd had an ectopic pregnancy. And she kind of said to me, but you're going to be here all on your own over Christmas. So she used to get her own family to come in and visit me. Now, to this day, we are still very, very good friends. And her little boy that she had eventually, after the ectopic, I'm his godmother.
Oh, wow. How beautiful.
I know. Yeah, exactly. So when that week when I was down, and when she heard I was back down for treatment, again, I couldn't really say, but she wasn't daft. She knew that there was something going on. And she said, no, you're not staying in a B&B. You're coming to stay with me. So, I mean, I've been so blessed and so lucky with, you know, the people I've met through my journey. And so it was wonderful. And her mum actually was a midwife with and worked with Patrick.
Oh,
would you believe that? So
God, what a small world.
So that made such a difference, the fact that I was with somebody that I could talk to at night. Because, of course, I was so far away from home.
Mm.
And I couldn't tell my parents. We weren't allowed to tell anybody. So my family, friends, I just kept disappearing, you know, and they didn't know why. You know, even when I was down for at Christmas, my poor mother, I think, thought I had some awful disease that couldn't be cured in Scotland, and that was the reason I kept disappearing down to Oldham.
When you're describing it, I get a real sense of it's probably quite, you know, this fear that you're going down and you didn't know what to expect. You don't know what was going to happen. You didn't have, you know, anyone with you. But it sounds like you met people along the way that were really kind and they were really supportive throughout your journey. And I know you've mentioned Bob and Patrick and Jean a few times. How was it to work with them, and especially Jean being the focus of the new film Joy? And, you know, and my understanding is once the eggs were retrieved, she kind of took over in terms of taking care of the women, but also taking care of the embryos.
Oh, Jean was just the most amazing person. We became, again, very, very close friends. Jean was, she was the glue that kept everybody together. You know, she had an amazing way of very calmly, because she was very shy in many ways, and not quite the way she was portrayed in the film. She had the strength. No, she was a strong, very strong person, but she did it in a very unassuming and caring way. And she always seemed to be able to know how we were feeling. And especially, as I said, when I was there on my own, that's when Jeannie and I became really close, because, you know, as you said, she was responsible for the lab, for looking after us, for making sure everything ticked over properly. But the one thing that used to make me laugh was that Bob was the most amazing, loveliest, kind person. But he was a wee bit harum scarum when it came to taking notes and things. He would just jot them down on wee bits of paper. And it was Jeannie who would always kind of collate all of this and make sure that all of the you know, the findings were kept properly, so that they could use them. If something went wrong, then she was able to then work it out that, you know, if we could try another way, or we'd be able to, well, that's them in the tiny little laboratory that they had, but, you know, that there was maybe another way that they could try this. So it was, I mean, Patrick was lovely, but he was more, I think, because of his experiences, he always kind of held himself back slightly, I think, because of all the disappointments with all the people that he'd had to operate on that didn't work. I think that was his mechanism for coping. You know, he was lovely. Once we got to know him afterwards, he was a different man. But at that time, he kind of kept him, you know, so that I think it was a protective shield round himself.
Mm.
But Bob and Jeannie, yeah, were the ones that we had much, much more contact with.
Yeah. And step two, I think you played quite a key role in the whole development of laparoscopy and using it to treat women with gynecological problems.
Absolutely. That's what made it. That's what how Bob was able to be able to carry on, because they needed somebody that could access the egg before it was released from the ovary. So when he went to that conference, which was right, and he'd heard about Patrick before that, but Patrick was an amazing man. He'd actually, I think, found out all about laparoscopy from Germany. And he definitely was. He was a pioneer of laparoscopy in his own right. Although I'd had a laparoscopy done to me by Dr. Mackay Hart back in 1972, you know, so it wasn't unheard of.
And it just kind of takes me back. So I mean, like you, I also have endometriosis, and I've gone through a number of laparoscopies. So I understand how, you know, the advancements way back when have a huge influence on today and in the healthcare sector. But kind of, I know the film Joy has come out recently, and you were quite involved in terms of helping, for example, Jack Thorne and Rachel Mason with their research and to understand actually what was the story back then. And it kind of did Jean also have endometriosis, and she was also trying to become a mother, but was sadly unsuccessful.
I don't know. I can't swear to that, but I don't know that that is technically actually accurate. Jean was a very staunch Christian, and part of the thing in the film, I don't know how to put this, but I don't think that was Jean. She would never. She didn't sleep with anybody else. That part, I think, is just for drama.
Yeah, dramatization.
Yeah, dramatization. But in a way, it was a shame, because I knew the Jeanie I knew was a very devout Christian. She was a very good person. And as far as I was aware, she didn't have boyfriends. And she was dedicated to us, as, you know, going through all of that. And she wanted to, she definitely wanted to get married and have children, but she wouldn't have gone through, you know, that bit of it. I don't quite know why Jack and Rachel have put that bit in, as you say, probably just for dramatization. Because in all the years I knew Jeanie, well, until poor soul, she passed away, I never knew about her having endometriosis. And I'd had it, and she knew that, but she never mentioned it to me. And I know that we did talk about she would have loved children, and she adored Alistair. I've got lovely pictures of her holding Alistair and playing with him on the floor in Bourne Hall when he was only about 18 months, 2 years old. You know, and she would have made the most amazing, wonderful mother. She really would have. But all these babies, she used to say that all, you know, after Alistair, she would say, these are all going to be my babies.
And in a way they were, because she was instrumental in them coming into the world. So she played such a key role. But then when, I think it was in the second trial that you fell pregnant with Alistair, and you stayed there for a few weeks. How was it going through the pregnancy? And then you had a reporter come and knock on your door to tell you that you'd had the world's second IVF baby.
Yeah, because I was there from the beginning of May till into July, because I kept having breakthrough bleeding. So they didn't want to send me home. So that's why I was still there when the last batch of girls came into Kershaw's. And then eventually I got the all clear from Bob. He was just wonderful. Even when I first became pregnant, he kept saying to me, I don't want you to be upset, because the other girls that I was in, he said, the other girls will be going home, but you'll be staying here. And Jeanie, that was when Jeanie really looked after me. And when I did go home, I thought, well, this is it. That's wonderful. But when I was about 5 months pregnant, May, June, July, August, September. Yeah, round about October, this reporter came to my house and said, oh, you're Grace. I said, yes. You're going to have the second IV, or at that time, test tube. He said, you're going to have the second test tube. And I said, I don't know where you got your information from, but that's absolute rubbish. And he said, no, I know that you're, because I assumed by that time there was going to be loads more. Because I knew that, you know, that after Leslie and me, there was a long time, you know. So I thought in all those months, there's bound to be others, because you know how you just assume things. So that came as a real shock to me when he told me that. And I said, but where are you getting your information? And I was devastated when he told me that one of the nurses in Oldham had actually sold our names.
Oh, wow.
I know. Isn't that awful? So that's how he knew.
Gosh.
But he was actually, to be fair to him, I did say to him, if that is the truth, please leave us alone. I don't want any publicity. And can you not understand how traumatic this is for me going through it at this stage? So he held off. He said, well, I'll hold off, that the other papers are going to get a hold of it. And if I get, if I hear of that, then he wanted the scoop. So I didn't talk to him, but he then, when a few weeks later, he did publish it in the papers. So that's when we actually had to leave our house. We couldn't, because we were inundated. It was awful, actually. I had to go and stay with my best friend over in Glasgow. And the weirdest thing was, she's still my best friend, but she lived two doors down, editor of the Glasgow Herald. And they were looking all
gosh.
I was two doors down.
Hiding in the hideout.
Hiding in my friend's house.
So then when it was published in the paper, so did you have a lot of press turning up, and did you have family and friends getting in contact saying they've read it about, you know, are you having this baby?
Well, yeah, that's when I had to go through, and after that reporter came, that's when we broke it to our family. And our family is, because up till then, my poor mother was convinced that I had some awful terminal illness, because I kept disappearing for months, she thought it was months. It was maybe a couple of months. And I couldn't tell them, you know, what was wrong. So I think it came as a huge shock to my mum, but such a, you know, she was just so happy, you know, for me. But at the time, I felt terrible that we weren't allowed to even tell, you know, our nearest and dearest. But then I understood why, that it happened anyway, not through us, but through someone else actually giving our names away.
And how comfortable were you talking about or telling people, or did you tell people of your own accord that you'd had a baby through these trials and Alistair's a test tube baby, or did you keep that very much a secret?
When he was born, it did again. We had peace from about then till he came a month early, in the 14th of January instead of the 14th of February. And then, of course, it then hit the headlines everywhere. So I didn't really have to explain. It was all laid out for us. And Patrick and Bob, very, very supportive. And Jean, you know, just saying, you don't need to say to anybody. What they suggested was that we signed with one paper only, which gave us protection, really. It kept all the other papers. Although they did come to our house and try and you know, come up. But my neighbours in the, you know, the little cul-de-sac I live in, they closed right, and they actually blocked off the street to stalk them. So it was
a good idea.
I've been so blessed, really, with, you know, people that have been so kind to us, because they just wouldn't let them in. You know, there was people from all over the world, you know, film cameras. Like, I remember when I was in the hospital, they were even trying to come in to the, you know, the wards that I was in when Alistair was born. Wow. In January. It was unbelievable. But I guess maybe in many ways I didn't really appreciate, even at that stage, just what a big, big breakthrough, medical breakthrough this was. I only really saw it as, this is my baby. It's got nothing to do with anybody else.
At which point did it really hit you how big of a deal this was and how everyone in the world is watching with interest and wanting to know about your story?
I think it really hit home when Bob and Patrick did the conference, and when, you know, which they did and the kind of later in January. Then I realized, oh my goodness, you know, this is going to be a very, very big medical breakthrough. I think I was at that stage just hoping, because they were much the same. They didn't want us to be in the spotlight, which I didn't want either, because Leslie and John had come up in February with Alistair, and we all met, you know, so Leslie had also told me what a terrible time she'd had. There were six months between Alistair and Louise. And when they came up in the February, Louise was obviously just a very small baby. But Leslie was a great help to me. We became, again, very firm friends right up until, unfortunately, she passed away. But she and I, we used to compare notes all the time, because we at least felt that we had come through the same thing and we had such a lot in common. But I really took to heart, yeah, when she told me, when I met her when Alistair was only about a month old, she said she felt that she had been, that Louise's childhood had been stolen from her, baby, you know, as a baby, because she felt that, she was the world's possession, not her baby. So I was determined that I wasn't going to allow that to happen to me and Alistair.
Wow. And that must have been quite an experience then, for her to have gone through everything she went through to get Louise, and for then to be in a position where everyone's kind of involved, everyone wants to know, everyone kind of wants to see, you know, the world's first IVF baby. So I can imagine that would be quite difficult. So at which stage did Alistair know that he was born through IVF?
He found out, believe it or not, he found out himself. I was always obviously going to explain it to him, but I thought, well, there was no need to, you know, too soon, because to me, he was just my wee boy, but the day that Patrick passed away in May 1988, Alistair saw it on the television and he started crying, and I said, "What's wrong, Alistair?" And he said, Uncle Patrick's has died." That's the way his Uncle Patrick's died. "And I saw my friend Louise on the television. Am I like Louise? I must be a test tube baby too." And I said, "Exactly, Alistair, that's who you are, but you're no different."
Yeah.
You know, that he was so upset at losing Patrick. So eventually, obviously after that, he was so inquisitive, he wanted to know all about it and what had happened. But being Alistair, he just took it all in his stride and was very interested. He's got that kind of scientific mind.
Yeah.
And that, all right, Mum, that makes sense. You know, even at nine.
Oh, bless him.
He and Bob, I mean, were just amazing together. They got on so, so well and just sparked off each other. He adored Bob, and a lot of Alistair's life, he used to say, "I want to make Bob proud of me," and because unfortunately Patrick had passed away by that time, but he cared so much about what Bob thought of him, and it's been, because he always used to say that Bob was his hero, and still is, you know, to this day.
Gosh, and that's just, yeah, that's amazing to think that Bob was instrumental in bringing him into this world, and then he and Alistair just looked up to him. That's a beautiful thing to witness. And I suppose, how did you, given your journey, your experience, how did you feel when you heard about the film Joy? And tell us a bit more about how you got involved with that.
Well, it was through Bourne Hall, who have always been very, very supportive of Alistair and I, even although that wasn't where Alistair was born, but they really have adopted us as being one of the born babies, as to say, you know, to put it that way. But Louise and Alistair are very much accepted as being very important to Bourne, because it was Jeannie that set it up. It was Jeannie that found it. It was Rachel at Bourne Hall who got in touch with me and said that she'd heard that there was this film and this couple who were hoping to make this film, and that she did explain that they had also had real problems with conceiving. So that meant an awful lot to me. So she said, can I put them in touch with you? And I said, of course. So we had a long, long convert like this. It was a video call at the end of last year, and they were just lovely. What lovely, lovely people. And we just chatted like I'm chatting to you. And they just wanted to know all about Jeannie and what it had been like for me. So just what you've been asking me, really, it was almost like a repeat. Just let them know what it was like for us girls, being together, going through there was the ups and downs, the trauma, you're worried sick, are you going to go home, with nothing, or are you going to be successful? So that's where I gave them all the information really that I could from what my own experience had been.
I've seen the film and it's just so moving, and I think the story will resonate with so many people. But how did you feel once you saw the kind of the final version, the final, produce of kind of all the conversations that you've had?
As Alistair had to keep telling me, Mum, it's a dramatisation, it's not a documentary, because I kept saying, technically, Alistair, that didn't happen, but he said, Mum, it's a film. But we were both in tears. We absolutely loved it. I've now seen it twice.
Yeah.
And I'll watch it again because I just absolutely loved it. And it brings back so many memories, Anita.
I bet.
And some, especially the girls that have, weren't successful. That's what breaks my heart, because and Alistair keeps saying, Mum, when are you going to write your book? Because I could write a book literally just about the girls. But I've never done it.
You should.
But one of these days, maybe the pair of us should do it. Because Alistair's story is really interesting too. How he's grown up and what he's been through in his life. From a different angle to me, of course. I'm the mum, but he's the person that he's the proof. He's the proof that it worked.
12 million babies later, after all these years, and it's testament to women like you, Grace, who are willing to go through the trials. And I know there was a lot of talk around, if it doesn't work for us, it's for the women of the future. And there are so many women that will be so thankful for that breakthrough. I've seen you and Alistair together. I met you at Fidelity Network's 20th birthday anniversary, and you can see a spark between you two, how much you adore him. And what really struck me is when you gave your speech at that event and how passionate you are about, the fact that women go through these things and they need support and people deserve to have children. So I just wanted to get some closing thoughts and remarks from you about what does it mean for you, and what would you like the future to look like in terms of fertility?
I think it's wonderful how far we have come, but I still think there's a long way to go. But to me, it does all hinge on supporting one another and help, well, obviously, the Fertility Network, I think, is amazing in the help and the support that you are giving women. We didn't have that. There was nothing like that. And I wish there was, because I think it could have helped an awful lot, because it was very traumatic for us. And some of the girls couldn't cope with it. They really, you know, I mean, I don't want to go into all the details, but I do know that for some, it was devastating. And, if there had been something like your network to be able to say to them, well, go and speak to so-and-so. That's what I think has been, to me, is one of the most wonderful things that people like you have done so much to support women like me. I think that it in the future, I wish that there could be more done in the early stages to make them understand and prepare them, because it still doesn't work for everybody. But if the it's that support that they need through all of it, whether it's for success or for being let down at the end of it, but to be able to cope with it is, I think, a very important thing. And the network, I think, would be wonderful in just from the word go, to be there as this crutch for everybody that needs it.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head. It's a lot of, and it's you still see it now where women and couples go through it in isolation. They feel alone. They don't know who to talk to. And sometimes yes. Just having someone can make a world of difference. And yeah, things are getting a lot better and people are being more open. But yeah, like you say, you need it from the start all the way through the end. And depending on the ending, you might need a bit more. And, you know, it's
exactly.
It's great that, you know, and it's even more amazing that you're coming on board as a patron for Fertility Network UK. And I'm sure collectively we'll strive, made strides towards making these changes. So, Grace, I wanted to just thank you so, so, so much for this conversation. It's been so insightful. I love going back into history to understand the roots of IVF, but more so your personal experience, what it was like for you. And yeah, I'm just in awe of your bravery and courage to share and help others.
Oh no, thank you. I'm absolutely delighted, and I'm very honored to have been asked to be a patron of the Fertility Network. And I hope that I can be helpful or an inspiration maybe to some people. That if I can do it, anyone can do it.
Absolutely, Grace.
It's just have the faith to believe that you can do it, I think is very important.
Definitely. A great way to end. So have faith and believe in yourself to make the right decisions for yourself. A huge thank you to Grace for sharing her personal story and really painting the picture and taking us back to a time that was difficult, and her experiences of going through the trials and doing it alone, and her experiences with the press, and just being part of something so big that changed the world for those who wanted to be parents. And so many years later on, Grace is still so passionate about providing treatment for individuals who want to become parents, and she is so inspirational, and her resilience to become a mother is just so powerful. And led her to those trials. And I really did feel transported back in time and able to actually get a sense of what it was like to be back in those moments. So a very, very huge thank you again to Grace. If you are at all triggered by the content in today's discussion, please do reach out via fertilitynetworkuk.org.
We will be back in a few weeks with another insightful episode. And if you found the episode helpful or useful in any way, please do leave a review and do rate the episode. Thank you for listening, and see you soon.